on the other foot. The media's flaws are our flaws. The media's shortcomings are our own. The members of the press may not all look like and vote like middle American conservative evangelicals in red Trumper hats, and that's okay. It's not a secret. The frictionless media world we live in today makes it easier than ever to fact-check, argue, debate, and contest biased coverage on all sides. The way to move past bad or biased media is to produce better media, not to engage in state threats. The press is never perfect and will never please all sides. But the idea of the leader of the free world revving up his mob to intimidate reporters or to use the awesome power of his office to shut down media outlets would have been repugnant to the founders. Trumpism now demands its votaries believe that conservative values and conservative policies are better served by government intimidation, bullying, and restrictions on the rights guaranteed under the Constitution than by the Constitution itself. It's a sign of how fallen, compromised, and sick the conservative movement has become under this man's spell. Free speech is still too rare in the world. Having the President of the United States as an implacable enemy of that freedom is a grotesque example for the rest of the world. Trump's ideal media looks like the press in places like Iran, Turkey, Egypt, Venezuela, and North Korea. In those nations, the liberal media know their place and only print what their respective dear leaders find pleasing. When independent journalism is allowed at all, censorship, spying, and demands that media outlets follow state propaganda templates make it nearly impossible for informed public discourse. Print and broadcast outlets are strictly licensed and controlled, and often are owned by the families of leading government officials. Online reporting is subject to intense government monitoring. Harassment, violence, and physical intimidation are routine features in the lives of reporters in nations lacking the fundamental press freedoms our founders wrote into the operating system of the United States. In those nations, censorship and state control of the media are features of their political landscape. Trump's "I can't believe the media is allowed to write anything they want" is the language of despots and tyrants. In many ways, this attack on the press and the roaring approval by Republicans illustrates the real divide in American conservatism today. It isn't simply about Trumpism versus conservatism. It's about statism versus constitutional freedom. Republicans are failing the test of our time and slipping into the warm bath of totalitarian language, practice, and politics. The conservative critique of oppressive states once centered on the suppression of speech and the use of state power to silence dissent. Today, conservatives are rushing to embrace Trump's attacks on NBC, CNN, The Washington Post, The New York Times, and any other media outlet refusing to bend the knee. The reason the click-servatives flood the zone for Trump isn't because they embrace the same nationalist hooey as Breitbart or Gateway Pundit. They know better. For many, it's a shtick, playing the rubes for clicks and ad revenue. For all that conservative websites, writers, and blogs mocked the BuzzFeed model of AI listicle storytelling, they've become what they loathed. 5 Reasons Robert Mueller is Satan is the click-servative equivalent of, "You won't believe these cute puppies playing on Kim Kardashian's bed." Or, "Take this quiz to learn what Disney princess you'd be in medieval France." Some see the Trump culture of endless media confrontation as a felicitous moment to write clickbaity, hair-pulling essays about the left and the media being infinitely worse than a man who fails every standard of conservatism. I had this old-fashioned notion that standards were part of what made conservatives what they were. But the liberal media excuse feels increasingly thin as Trump's failings are increasingly obvious. Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity plays a singular role in Team Trump's media cheer squad. The biggest name on the biggest cable network, Hannity also hosts the #2 rated radio talk show in the country. He's a bright, bright star in the newly defined conservative firmament, because all that matters now is constant, endless, fawning praise of Trump and endless vitriol for his opponents. Already successful, Hannity rose to new heights during the era of Trump. All it took was cashing in all his conservative priors. As with so many other on-air conservatives, Sean Hannity bailed on the tenets of conservative orthodoxy he claimed to advocate on his rise to influence. Hannity smelled something in the wind as Trump rose in the polls in 2015 and switched into overdrive. Without missing a beat, he's become the loudest voice on Fox, and therefore the one media silo that matters to Trump, as the proselytizer and enforcer of Trump jucha. He even spends his evenings on the phone with the president. I can't help imagining them like a pair of teenage girls on their prince's phones. You hang up first. No, you hang up first. Love you. Love you more. It's paid off for Hannity in spades. His evening Fox show is the highest rated on cable news. His radio show draws 13.5 million listeners. Sean Hannity's combined daily reach is more than 13 million Americans. And these days, they're there for one thing and one thing only. Unconditional love for the Donald and Sean's daily 2 minutes of hate for anyone not on board with Trump. Sure, Hannity's populist, woke, working man shtick rings a bit hollow now that he lives in a multi-million-dollar mansion and owns a private jet, but the man is a profit-making machine for Fox and for premier radio networks. Republicans have long engaged in hissy fits over the relations between Democratic elected officials and the news media. Hell, there's a cottage industry of books blaming this bias for every failing of the conservative movement for the past 60 years, and plenty of grist for the mill, though the case is often rather wildly overstated. In my 30 years in political consulting, I've pushed back on hundreds of stories I believe were biased, sloppy, or based on dumb predicates. I also praise good reporting, even from folks in the media I knew were wildly to my left, and maintained good relations with reporters and editors because I went at the facts, worked the details, and pushed back like a professional. Making the rookie media mistake of confusing correlation for causation is sine qua non for the Republican media critics. Early in 2015, I realized Republicans were using the media bias angle not to get their side of the argument into the media ecosystem, but to create a hermetic bullshit bubble of confirmation bias. I looked back at some of the writing I'd done in the past couple of years about the media and found I'd been falling into the same trap. Many times, critics of the press have been right to note the cultural and social connections and affinities between the elite media and liberal politicians. Cozy relationships between the powerful and those who report on them have been an obsession for conservatives since Ben Bradley and John F. Kennedy chased tail and drank too much in Washington. The marriage and family relationships of Obama administration officials to reporters covering the White House were the subject of much conservative hyperventilation. Sean Hannity is the frenzied endpoint of this particular flavor of conservative hypocrisy. The role he plays for Trump would launch a thousand screaming media research center and Breitbart articles if the partisan brogue were on the other foot. Imagine for a moment the Republican meltdown that would have come to pass if, hypothetically, Joe Scarborough had spent weeks advising Barack Obama on how to respond to the Benghazi investigation, or if Jake Tapper had counseled Hillary Clinton on her email server scandal. The incandescent, ass-on-fire meltdown would have been one for the ages. Oddly, conservatives saw absolutely nothing wrong when Hannity's role as a Trump campaign advisor leaked out in the midst of the 2016 campaign. Hannity spent every night grunting out a relentlessly pro-Trump message on television while also serving as an advisor to the campaign. As an entrepreneurial power play, it was the marriage of a reality TV show candidate to a talk show host. Trump loved it because Hannity never shaded his coverage in any direction but full-on Trumpisma. Hannity loved it because it was a ratings bonanza, and Trump was whispering about a post-Fox Trump TV project. "I'm not hiding the fact that I want Donald Trump to be the next president of the United States," Hannity told the New York Times. "I never claimed to be a journalist." "Oh, we understood that part, Sean. Trust me." The New York Times reported that the Fox host, quote, "peppered Mr. Trump, his family members, and advisors with suggestions on strategy and messaging." Hannity's massive platforms delivered the Trump message to the GOP primary audience, undercutting many of the formerly rising stars of the party whom Sean had highlighted for years. In Hannity land, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, and the rest were reduced to afterthoughts at best, targets at worst. Fox favorites like Ben Carson also disappeared from the network's most-watched hour of television. When the election shifted to the general, Hannity went into overdrive. He peddled some of the most batshit crazy theories about Hillary Clinton's health, echoing the lunatic trolling of lispy lunatic Mike Cernovich and others. The moment the Hannity-Trump marriage was sealed, though, was in the Trump campaign's darkest hour. When the world was falling down around Donald Trump's head in the wake of the Access Hollywood pussy-grabber revelations, it was Sean Hannity, almost alone in the top ranks of the conservative media who sprang to Trump's defense. He turned the story, at least to the tribal base of Trump's GOP cohort, into a tale of the perfidy of Bill and Hillary Clinton. His full-throated defense of Trump's locker room talk told Trump that Hannity would never abandon him for anything as trifling as the truth or morals. It was one thing for conservative keepers of America's media mores to look away from Hannity's direct involvement in the campaign of Donald Trump. It was quite another that they saw nothing wrong with the President of the United States, the head of the world's longest-running and most successful experiment in constitutional democracy, taking marching orders from a blowhard talk show host. Hannity's role as a political enforcer for Trump was clear within weeks of the election. Lest any Republican voice even the slightest concern over Trump's policies, statements, or tweeting, they could count on Sean Hannity to hammer them, and for Hannity's audience to turn their Facebook and Twitter feeds into a nightmare of grammatically challenged but passionate MAGA-gasms. One member told me that the 1-2 punch of a Trump tweet against him, followed by Hannity's follow-on attack, made him consider shutting down his social media accounts. The irony of Hannity going after conservatives like Ben Sasse, Mitch McConnell, Bob Corker, and John McCain was rich. Trump, a man with no ideological moorings, was being held up by Hannity as a paragon of conservative virtue. Watching him rage against Republican critics of Trump reminded me of a quote by a noted specialist in the semiotics, hermeneutics, and metaphysics of Trump and Trumpism, Jacoby Murgatu. "I feel like I'm taking crazy pills." Noted nuclear weapons expert, Middle East policy guru, and fluent Farsi speaker Sean Hannity also advised Donald Trump on how to handle the continuation of the nuclear weapons deal President Barack Obama struck with Iran. I mean, it's only one of the most consequential decisions a president can make about the future political, diplomatic, and military landscape of the Middle East. So why not consult a talk show host with a high school education? Why not ask for advice from a man who makes even the most superficial, talking head policy lightweights seem like a combination of Metternich, John Foster Dulles, and Henry Kissinger? A media low point in the Hannity experience came in the wake of the death of Democratic National Committee staffer Seth Rich. Rich, who was killed by muggers in Washington, was the subject of some of the most baroque, cruel, and downright insane conspiracy theories ever to hit the Clintons, who were a magnet for this kind of cray to begin with. Hannity jumped in feet first. Hannity tried to outflank Alex Jones, leading his own network to retract the story that launched this particularly embarrassing line of conspiratorial nuttery. The nut of this claim was that Seth Rich was murdered for leaking the DNC emails to WikiLeaks. It was widely, thoroughly, exhaustively debunked well before Hannity took up the story again in May of 2017. Think of it as Pizzagate, only even more tendentiously stupid, wrong, and cruel to the parents of Rich, who called the garbage theory something promoted by disgusting sociopaths. David French, writing in National Review, made what I think was a perfect indictment of Hannity's role in this shameful mess. "It's a dramatic and lurid misdirection, one that even the writers of House of Cards would find far-fetched. And it has the benefit of tricking gullible Trump supporters into further mistrusting the media. After all, the real story is over at Gateway Pundit or at Breitbart or Drudge or on Fox News at 10 p.m. The true facts are known only to those who can perceive the pure evil of the Clintons, the deep state, and the rest of the establishment media." None of it stopped Hannity, who enlisted a clown college of Fox contributors like Newt Gingrich and Geraldo Rivera to echo the theory that the Clinton enterprise had Seth Rich murdered, even reviving the ludicrous 1990s Clinton body count conspiracy theories. The market did to Hannity what any innate sense of decency could not. As his advertisers started to abandon his show, reality set in. Even Fox News, an organization with a Roy Cohn-esque, never apologize, never defend, never give an inch, punch back twice as hard PR approach, was forced to apologize and withdraw the story. Hannity briefly also became a line of defense for Trump and Bannon's candidate in the Alabama Senate race, teen curious and creepy Judge Roy Moore. It was a sign that the moral rot in the conservative media didn't skip Sean when it came to defending a pedophile. More advertisers bailed, and Roy Moore's problems were beyond even Sean's ability to ignore. Hannity's role as Trump advisor and enforcer never varied, and by the end of Trump's first year in office, the Fox feedback loop, as coined by Vanity Fair's Gabriel Sherman, was complete. Sherman, describing the cycle, put it like this: "Fox may be Trump's safe space, but Trump is Fox's safe space too. It's a circular feedback loop. The expulsion and subsequent death of Roger Ailes, a man with a true gift for creating television, meant the network was unmoored. It still had producers and air talent who could play from the songbook Roger left behind, but it lacked a real conductor from that moment forward. Following the Trump wave was its only real option, and one that still made the network over $1.5 billion in 2016. Understanding the centrality of Fox News and Hannity in particular, in the way Donald Trump shapes his message, strategy, and national policy, is vital to understanding how deeply broken this presidency was from the start. The institutions of media and government were, in the eyes of the founders, separate. Even in our darkest hours, our nation has been cautious about the power of state propaganda, as we have been cautious about state-run media. No, libertarians, Big Bird, and NPR don't count. Fox and Hannity have upended that. If you're a conservative who sees this as a good outcome merely because Fox is nominally conservative, you might want to examine your priors. The president of the United States is addicted to an endless stream of praise from a shallow, dangerously stupid man. That same dangerous, stupid man feeds America's president a constant flow of conspiracy nonsense, uncritical praise, and uninformed opinion. It's a disaster in every way but the ratings. Ann Coulter. Ann Coulter, tales of whom are whispered in dark rooms to frighten children, went from being a snarky, in-your-face hyper-conservative to a tiresomely relentless Trump cheerleader based on his promise to deport 13 million people and build the infamous wall. If there's one person who displays the ETTD agony of being on a constant roller coaster ride of Trump adoration to condemnation, it's Coulter. Her arc, like that of so many Trump backers from the conservative media, could only ever end one way. Hot, angry tears and a morning after binge of chain-smoking Marlboro Reds, hammering back indifferent box wine Chardonnay, and devouring the souls of orphans. Frank Bruni perfectly framed Coulter's unique position in the Trump media ecosystem. So Coulter was Trump's muse. She was also his oracle, predicting his nomination and election back when most others still dismissed him as a joke. And she's a barometer of, and tribune for, some of his core supporters, including her good friend Matt Drudge. Watching Anne's on-again, off-again relationship with Trump rise and fall with his positions on immigration has been a genuine pleasure. I can hear her, a la Fatal Attraction, whispering into the phone, "Don, I won't be ignored." It was the definitional issue for Coulter and a handful of other paleocons, and the subject of her obsessive, bunny-boiling rages. It showed us just how little the rest of the conservative portfolio mattered to her when she tweeted, "I don't care if real Donald Trump wants to perform abortions on the White House lawn after this immigration policy paper." The recursive irony was that she'd helped write the immigration policy paper she described as, quote, "the greatest political document since the Magna Carta." At the direction of Steve Bannon, Coulter and Stephen Miller had crafted the white nationalist immigration plan she was praising. Donald Trump, king of the political pump and dump, would betray Coulter, and she would return the favor. By early 2018, the author of E Pluribus Awesome in Trump We Trust was in full-on psycho ex-girlfriend mode. After a year of prevarications, lies, and typical Trumpian bullshit over immigration, Coulter's patience was exhausted. Her own rage tweets started, and their relationship deteriorated to the point of an obscenity-filled Oval Office screaming match. By Coulter's account, she was greeted by Trump as the great betrayer, and Trump mumbling, "but Gorsuch." By the time Trump signed the 2018 omnibus spending bill, the romance was strained to the breaking point. In a bitter, testy appearance at Columbia, Coulter would say of Trump, "I knew he was a shallow, lazy ignoramus, and I didn't care." Oh, Anne, you really are in touch with the Trump mindset. Trump Bart. If you're looking for a weaponized, white-hot, immigrant-hating, trailer-trash, post-conservative nationalist populism, look no further than Donald Trump's loudest screaming section, Breitbart News. How could Breitbart News have risen faster or fallen harder? After Andrew Breitbart's death in 2012, Steve Bannon became the new capo of the enterprise, marked it with his own special ichor, and went all in on what would become the main operating principle of the new right media, provocation over reporting, instigation over analysis, and jackassery over all. They were outsider media for an outsider president. Not everyone in Breitbart was happy about it at first. McKay Coppins, in his 2017 book The Wilderness, reported, "According to four sources with knowledge of the situation, editors and writers at the outlet have privately complained since at least last year that the company's top management was allowing Trump to turn Breitbart into his own fan website, using it to hype his political prospects and attack his enemies." For a time, it looked as if Bannon's twin bets on the alt-right and Donald Trump would pay off big. As candidate and president, Trump was often presented with glowing Breitbart headlines, which would leave him giggling and smiling like a D student being told he's brilliant and accomplished. Their turn to Trump was sharply clear in mid-2015, to the point I tore Alex Marlow, Breitbart's editor-in-chief, a new one on CNN, telling him that Breitbart was Trump's Pravda. It hit a nerve. But Breitbart also fell victim to the Trump curse. They were the id of the right wing of American politics from the beginning of Bannon's tenure, and worked hard to play the trigger-the-lib-snowflake-tears game to its hilt. When Breitbart was just Bannon's troll site, headlines like, "Birth control makes women crazy and unattractive," might have been laughed off. But as the brand became permanently stained by their close association with the alt-right, anti-immigrant agitprop, and as Donald Trump's media mouthpiece, trouble appeared on the horizon. Their self-reinforcing vicious cycle meant it wasn't enough to be edgy. Edgy wasn't going to feed the lunatic comments section folks. Chasing the clickbait dragon meant headlines got louder, the stories got wilder, and the politics got closer and closer to the fringe. Some examples. Bill Kristol, Republican spoiler, renegade Jew. "Hoist it high and proud, the Confederate flag proclaims a glorious heritage." "Would you rather your child had feminism or cancer?" Breitbart had long relied on three revenue drivers. Programmatic ad placements by large digital ad agencies, sweet, sweet chunks of quan from Robert Mercer, and Facebook traffic. Breitbart bragged in its public affairs materials about traffic, Facebook engagement, and a whole spectrum of other indicators. One thing they never mentioned? Revenue and profit. There was always a mystery about just how much cash Mercer dumped into the Bannon version of the house Andrew built. It was enough that Breitbart's ad sales and development team were always an afterthought, but not enough to where they could forego advertising. Those automatically placed ads from digital agencies didn't look at where the ads were placed, they merely looked at the demographics of sites and their traffic. It was the power of automated digital markets on autopilot. Then came Sleeping Giants and their counter-campaign. The Chicago Tribune called them, quote, "the mysterious group that wants to kill Breitbart's ad revenue one tweet at a time." When advertisers a million miles from Breitbart's political values were notified they were supporting Trump and the alt-right, the social pressure led to their blacklisting Breitbart. It wasn't a free speech question, as Breitbart's executives squealed like pigs. It was a market question. Who wants to be associated with a media outlet tied at the hip to the Pepe Brigade and the least popular president in history? No one, that's who. By late 2017, it was clear that Robert Mercer had reached his limits with Bannon, Breitbart, and the collection of trash people around its orbit. From deep-pocketed sugar daddy to "I barely know him" was a sign of just how far Bannon's fortunes had fallen. It's hard to imagine a sharper rebuke of Bannon than this from his former patron. "The press has also intimated that my politics marches in lockstep with Steve Bannon's. I have great respect for Mr. Bannon, and from time to time I do discuss politics with him. However, I make my own decisions with respect to whom I support politically. Those decisions do not always align with Mr. Bannon's. For personal reasons, I have decided to sell my stake in Breitbart News to my daughter." Advertisers have rapidly and steadily fled Breitbart News this year as the site's reputation is increasingly tied to the alt-right. So far, more than 2,500 companies have jumped ship, said the Sleeping Giants team. It wasn't about left or right. It was about markets in action. As Media Radar reported, 6 months ago, Breitbart was riding the wave of an election, plotting an international expansion to provide a platform to spread far-right populist views to Europe. But today, Breitbart is facing traffic declines, advertiser blacklists, campaigns for marketers to steer clear, and even a petition within Amazon for it to stop providing ad services. Isn't capitalism grand? Facebook changed its algorithm in the spring of 2018 to reduce the prevalence of fake news sites driving clickbait edge case lunacy. You'll be shocked to learn that Breitbart's numbers took a sharp dive when Facebook upped their quality filter. The curse touched the edge case reporters who kept pushing the brand deeper into the weeds. We'll cover Milo Yiannopoulos in a separate section. Katie McHugh, a vicious little racist even by Breitbart standards, was an overt alt-writer who was fired after a series of tweets that were, and ride with me here, too racist even for Breitbart. McHugh's tweets have included, "There would be no deadly terror attacks in the UK if Muslims didn't live there," and "The only way to strike a balance between vigilance, discrimination, and terror is to end Muslim immigration," and "British settlers built the USA. Slaves built the country as much as cows built McDonald's." Lee Stranahan was forced out because he was too lunatic even for Breitbart and is now reduced to reporting for the Russian government propaganda agency Sputnik. At least he's cut out the middleman. Pudgy virgin Matt Boyle, the site's lead political reporter, is an unkempt little beach ball, full of fury at the establishment, unalloyed praise for Donald Trump, and endless tender rejections. He thought he'd end up as Breitbart's Ben Bradley, but is increasingly marginalized in the wave of mainstream reporting that truly gets inside the doings of the Trump White House. I'm sure you can hear the sound of my tiny violin playing right now as I close this section, because if there was a single alt-right pro-Trump media outlet that went all in and expected to change the game of conservative media, it was Breitbart. It was the bet of all bets, and Bannon's leadership there ensured they were permanently bound to the rising and falling fortunes of Donald Trump. In late March 2018, the online metrics firm Comscore reported that Breitbart's traffic numbers had fallen as sharply as their advertising revenue. Between January of 2017 and January 2018, Breitbart's traffic dropped 51%. Engagement of Breitbart's traffic on Facebook and other social media platforms vanished. If there's one media ETTD story that shows the entire arc of how dangerous tying one's fortunes to Trump can be, it's the Breitbart story. Rising Trump stars crashing to earth. As the age of Trump dawned, a cluster of rising new right, alt-right, and Trump-right media stars blossomed. Just as Trump and his followers believed they represented a new era in politics, these folks believed they were the future of conservative journalism. Their contempt for actual conservative ideas and policies was vivid. They saw themselves as part of the hot new nationalist wave. The following list is by no means complete, but represents a few of the more prominent and colorful types who presumed they were destined for Trump-era greatness. Until the curse hit. Milo. What can be said of Milo Yiannopoulos that won't feed the singularity of ego need and attention-seeking that defines his entire character? A narcissist who rivals even Donald Trump, he was in some ways the perfect monster at the perfect moment. As one of the satellites orbiting Trump's world, Milo looked as if he was about to become a media star for the Trump era. He was one of the cool kids of the alt-right, blonde, flamboyant, provocative. Milo was just the kind of pretty provocateur Bannon wanted to inflame the desires of his growing alt-right fan base. He was fond of referring to Trump as daddy, and built a fan base off of his post-Gamergate move to Breitbart, where he produced a series of inflammatory juvenilia and alt-right agitprop. The arc of Milo's career and popularity rose fast with a national tour of college campuses, all in an effort to generate viral buzz over his liberal-triggering antics. There was a moment when Milo was almost interesting, a kind of political stunt character, a comments section troll made into a real boy. But then came the endless series of crashes. Karaoke in a bar full of white supremacists featuring Nazi salutes. A defense of pedophilia and a botched book deal all hit Milo hard. Then, during the height of Bannon-Dammerung, Robert Mercer tossed Milo to the wolves at the same moment he was disposing of the disgraced White House advisor. Milo's dangerous faggot tour of college campuses had been a provocation of the sort in which Bannon and Milo reveled. Campus riots were a part of their imagined culture war. For his corporate sponsor, it wasn't as appealing. Mercer's public note was a slap across Milo's sneering face. It read, Without individuals thinking for themselves, society as a whole will struggle to distinguish the signal of truth from the correlated noise of conformity. I supported Milo Yiannopoulos in the hope and expectation that his expression of views contrary to the social mainstream and his spotlighting of the hypocrisy of those who would close down free speech in the name of political correctness would promote the type of open debate and freedom of thought that is being throttled on many American college campuses today. But in my opinion, actions of and statements by Mr. Yiannopoulos have caused pain and divisiveness, undermining the open and productive discourse I had hoped to facilitate. I was mistaken to have supported him, and for several weeks have been in the process of severing all ties with him. Milo helped spread the alt-right's poison into the American political system. But for him, it wasn't ideological. Milo's sole needs set is about Milo. His fame-whoring over Trump tied neatly into the rise of the alt-right, and his flirtation with them was about associating his own brand with controversy rather than some ideological alignment. Milo's love of the transgressive isn't political. He's drawn to the gleaming eye of the camera, not by something deeper or more meaningful. His 15 minutes were firmly up even before the end of Trump's first year in office. Abandoned by Mercer, dumped by Breitbart, his tours impossible without a sugar daddy to support them, he was left doing nothing but a cam show from his Miami home. In a sad piece on the decline and decline of the former alt-right poster child, Tanya Gold of The Spectator quoted the fading star as saying, "People love me everywhere. It was a tumultuous 2017, but everyone who put Trump in the White House got punished somehow. It's what happens after elections." We speak again a few weeks ago. He has a new strategy, he says, because new media wants to destroy him. "We made a mistake handing over our distribution to people who want to exterminate us. Personalities like me are being strangled to death by Facebook and YouTube and Google and Twitter. I have millions of fans worldwide, but they can't get my stuff." Don't weep for Milo, though. When I last spotted him, he was hawking vitamins in the 30-day liver cleanse on an InfoWars webcast. Who says the universe doesn't have a sense of humor? Alex Jones. The dog's breakfast of conspiracy-driven, industrial-scale kook media in Trump's orbit has nothing on Alex Jones, the red-faced, hyperventilating host of the InfoWars network. Jones makes Breitbart look as measured and considered as the New Yorker in William Shawn's day. Of course, in the Trump era, no conspiracy is complete without an appearance by Roger Stone. Clad sometimes in a black t-shirt and beret, Stone frequently appears on InfoWars looking like a member of the Grey Panthers Viagra Liberation Front and sounding as if he's mainlining Red Bull, steroids, and the ghostly ectoplasm of Lyndon LaRouche. Stone and Jones are perhaps the most vocal promoters of the deep state theory in which America's intelligence agencies, the military-industrial complex, and other dark forces, including the Federal Reserve, the secret Zionist world government, the dudes from Eyes Wide Shut, and the lizard people manipulate the economy, the media, the justice system, and the fluoride in your water. Jones was an early, enthusiastic supporter of the oft-mentioned Pizzagate theory, in which Hillary Clinton is part of a global child kidnapping and cannibalism ring, and promoted the Seth Rich conspiracy. In both cases, Jones ran into a legal buzzsaw, hitting the skids in the spring of 2018. No longer allowed in even the farthest orbits of Trump world, he continued to support the president in his inimitably lunatic style. Like many other outlets on the fringes drawn into the political mix, InfoWars started to run afoul of social media platforms. As with neo-Nazis, at some point, private companies like YouTube and Facebook Jones used to spread his bat shittery realized his brand is consumer poison. Fearing YouTube and others would demonetize his videos, Jones was in a box. Feed the monster or save the cash flow. The surge from interviews with Trump helped normalize InfoWars with a kook set, but after its peak in November 2016, Jones was back to his usual sweaty screamfest farrago of UFO theories, amateur demonology, lurid conspiracy talk about the Bilderbergers, the Illuminati, the gray aliens, fluoride, chemtrails, Bigfoot, Jade Helm, Agenda 21, and the fish people. If you're ever looking for the perfect video clip to explain him, just search Alex Jones Fish People. It's worth it. Tommy Loren. A moment, if I may, about alt-right Barbie Tommy Loren. You've heard of her. Of course you've heard of her. She's a nonstop presence in the lives and minds of Trump world. The subject of a thousand fanfic moments in the heads of pudge-gutted, Trump trucker hat-wearing MAGAites, Tommy rocks an Aryan teen queen mane of blonde extensions, a bilious attitude, an acidic tongue, and a withered, blackened crust of a soul when it comes to anyone of the wrong race, religion, or national origin. Tommy is young. Tommy is quite pretty-ish in a kind of middle America, trashy, hot, fake Instagram model way. She's learned to read a teleprompter well and emotes the oppositional defiant disorder style of contemporary Trumpian republicanism with a certain livid verve. Tommy understands the way to the Trump demo's heart is pure, hot, constant hate. Tommy and I appeared on Real Time with Bill Maher on February 3rd, 2017. Even before the show, she seemed less confident than I would have expected for someone who, at the time, was a commentator for the new conservative One American News Network and a rising star in the Trump media firmament. As an aside, OANN is a dumpster fire of sparkly eagle-animated flag-waving warnings about the Muslim-Mexican conspiracy to bring Sharia-compliant illegal immigrants to America, and a truly brain-melting experience. She rolled into the show with a few well-prepared talking points about the then-frisky protests against the egregious Milo Yiannopoulos. They say live television shows who people really are. And that night, as Tommy lost the Trumpian narrative thread and started speaking from the heart, I saw the future of conservative media up close. She was Ann Coulter without the pungent smell of cat litter, Marlboro Reds, and despair. Bill Maher asked Tommy a question that would have worked perfectly for her on Fox or OANN. He said, "Two-thirds of Republicans agree that discrimination against whites has become as big a problem as discrimination against minorities. Do you agree with that?" After a little prevarication, Tommy stuck her head in the proverbial noose. "As we sit here today, I do think there's an element of racism against whites," she whinged. Given my low tolerance for bullshit, I wasn't going to put up with it and replied, "Since I'm a conservative and not a Trump person, let me say this. That's absurd. That's fucking crazy." The reaction across social media was not, to put it mildly, kind to Tommy. She didn't spend a lot of time at the after party. Tommy has a massive social media presence and a gig with Trump's Super PAC as its spokesbot, and is in regular rotation on Fox. She's also an utterly spoiled little trash fire of a human being, and thus a perfect exemplar of Trump's media enablers. The following transcript was provided by WikiLeaks in the fall of 2024. Intercept 5. Begin transcript. Special Counsel Robert Mueller. "Mr. President, thank you for sitting down with us today." Trump. "President, am I president?" Mueller. You are, sir." Trump. "I like television. I like to watch." Mueller. "Mr. President, I'd like to begin by discussing the June 9, 2016 Trump Tower meeting with representatives of the Russian government." Trump. "My name is Forrest Gump. People call me Forrest Gump." Mueller. "Very well. I'd like to discuss the payments to your campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, by..." Trump. "I'm an excellent driver. Wapner." Mueller. "Let's move on." Trump. "I like Lamp." Mueller. "On the date of..." Trump. "Stamina. Wall. MAGA. Incredible." Mueller. "June 9th, 2016, did you discuss..." Trump. "Hey, do you want to hear the most annoying sound in the world? Eeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeee Tower Moscow in the summer of 2016. Here's the prospectus and artist rendering of the tower. Trump: what is this, a tower for ants? Sound of table flipping. Transcript ends. Chapter 14. Trump's Island of Misfit Toys. Donald Trump's administration reflects him perfectly. Corrupt, angry, dumb, weird, ignorant of the world, venal as hell, and totally in over their heads. Americans were shocked by some of Trump's early hires, then stunned as they were chewed up and spat out, either by resignations or firings. It shouldn't have shocked anyone that Trump ground people to dust in the White House. Of course, Trump spins it differently. On March 6, 2018, days after firing Rex Tillerson, his Secretary of State, via tweet, naturally, he protested, The new fake news media narrative is that there is chaos in the White House. Wrong. People will always come and go, and I always want strong dialogue before making a final decision. I still have some people that I want to change, always seeking perfection. There is no chaos, only great energy. I mentioned the Emerson rule earlier, and in a lifetime of politics, I've seen that play out over and over again. Trump's administration is no different. As a younger man, fresh off the 1988 campaign trail, I had the honor to work as an appointee in the administration of George Herbert Walker Bush. Our 41st president led by example, expecting all of his appointees, from cabinet secretaries down to the lowest level staffer, to reflect the values of patriotism, modesty, judgment, humanity, and service that had helped shape his career. Moral examples work. When I worked for Rudy Giuliani in New York City Hall, the team culture was a combination of two-fisted, hands-on management and The Sopranos. We were high-speed, balls out all the time, filled with a sense of mission to restore and protect the greatest city in the world. We were also swaggering assholes with a, hey, fuck that fucking guy attitude. My God, that was fun. Nixon's paranoia and inferiority complex were ramified and reflected in his administration. Clinton's lack of personal and professional discipline led to a talented but chaotic train wreck of a White House. Obama's technocrats, reflecting their boss almost perfectly, believed that if they could just set up the right regulatory nudges, paradise awaited. Usually, American presidents of both parties have some virtuous streak in their character that allowed the Emerson rule to apply. No longer. We've gone from the best and the brightest to the dumb and the dangerous in 50 short years. By the time you listen to this, it will likely be out of date. Just in the few weeks before I turned this into my editors, the White House was firing people at a breakneck pace. Bad hirings and opera bouffe firings are a hallmark of Trump's administration, and by the time you've heard this, he will have fired, driven out, or caused over 50% of his staff to commit either real or metaphorical seppuku. The staggering turnover rate is the highest in modern history, rivaling only medieval royal courts in which the advisors to mad kings were poisoned, stabbed, thrown in wells, immured inside walls, eaten by wolves, carried off by plague, or killed by highwaymen. In the history of American politics, no campaign or administration can rival the sideshow cast of characters who composed Trump World. Instead of smart, dignified men and women striving to serve the nation in the people's house, they more closely resemble a casting call for the set of The Real Housewives of Bulgaria. Team Trump is the dross in the American political melting pot, combining raging crony capitalism, conflicts of interest, ideological dead ends, industrial-scale ass-kissing, and the worst instincts and beliefs scraped from the darkest corners of our national shame closet. It's an administration that combines astounding incompetence and consistent failure with a pungent combination of arrogance, bullish stupidity, and a relentless juvenile desire to run a government dedicated not to service but to offense. The collection of miscreants, nutcases, extremists, and dead-enders around Trump is an extended middle finger to American values, institutions, and anyone, anywhere not sufficiently awed by and obeisant to this president. Let's have a look at the cast of Trump's reality TV government, campaign hangers-on, oddball allies, creepy fans, and long-term troublemakers. Shall we? Steve Bannon. The brightest, hottest, weirdest, shittiest star in the Trump constellation from the moment of the Donald's unexpected electoral victory was Steve Bannon. If you're looking for the white-hot center of esoteric Trumpism, Bannon is its intellectual architect. Once you get past the homeless drifter with a hitchhiker's head in his backpack affect. Bannon, a man who looks like the spokesmodel for a new line of gout medication, is known for his oddball sartorial choices. The multiple shirts, the tactical operator pants, and the barber jacket are all hallmarks of his bus shelter chic style. Persistently rumpled, persistently grizzled, and persistently looking like he's been dragged over 30 miles of bad road, Bannon was no one's idea of the White House's dull but professional suit and tie culture. His roomy-eyed stare and the odd constellation of facial moles, warts, scrofula, weeping sores, and grizzled beard patches make him look vaguely piratical. A devotee of the alt-right's favorite writers, you haven't read Julius Evola in the original Italian? You're missing it all. And shoddy pop history like the Fourth Turning, Bannon is one of the two types of DC intellectuals. The first type are nerds who've read everything and can't sell anything. The second are Bannon types who want you to think they've read everything and are out to sell themselves. Bannon's confidence he's the smartest guy in the room isn't misplaced in Trump world, and certainly not in the presence of Trump. Famous non-reader Donald Trump, scanner of headlines, ignorer of summaries, writer of nothing longer than a tweet, has by many accounts never read much of anything and appears to have absolutely no interior intellectual life. He was a perfect mark for Bannon's blustery, whiskey-infused showmanship. Bannon would make a yeoman's effort to gentrify and polish Trumpism into nationalist populism. He would build not just a campaign, but a national movement around the idea, using Trump as its avatar, symbol, and martyr. Breitbart was famously scrappy, famously inflammatory, and a rising force on the right before Bannon. As head of Breitbart News, Bannon turned the site into a self-described voice of the alt-right and weaponized it to attack anyone he felt varied from the new, narrow confines of what he defined as conservatism. In the 2016 cycle, Bannon's suicide bomber version of the House Andrew built would be turned into a blowtorch against every other Republican candidate in the primary field. His minions were particularly hard on Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush, for whom Bannon's personal animus dripped from virtually every story. Bannon discovered immigration was the killer app in the Breitbart news mix, and it allowed him to shape the primary battlefield to Trump's advantage. For Trump, a man who craves favorable headlines like a meth junkie, Breitbart rewarded his impulsive behavior and extreme mood swings with better and better headlines. Trump would then use Breitbart as a driver for more of his own messages and policies, such as they were. The cycle fed on itself. Before Trump, it was an article of faith that Bannon and Breitbart would be all in for Ted Cruz, as Breitbart's sponsors, Robert and Rebecca Mercer, had stroked a series of eye-popping super PAC checks and made no secret of their love of the Texas senator. Bannon brokered their betrayal of Cruz in favor of Trump, and Trump for a time was taken by Bannon's shtick. Bannon's tenure in the Trump White House went about as well as expected. He's a sloppy thinker, largely disorganized and given to impulses that run him into political and ideological box canyons. He's also a man who loves to have enemies. He needs enemies, real and imagined, to function. In the Trump White House, his enemy was everyone, everywhere, all the time. Bannon fought with Ivanka and Jared. Bannon fought with Priebus. Bannon fought with Pence. Bannon famously fought with Gary Cohn and the other globalists among Trump's plutocratic economic advisors. Globalist is Bannonese for Jew, y'all. Just letting you know in case you've been living under a rock. Bannon fought and fought and fought himself out of a job. Before Trump, Bannon's political chops were, to put it mildly, marginal. He'd been a Navy officer, a Goldman Sachs guy, and had dabbled in Hollywood. His money came in large measure from owning a piece of the Seinfeld franchise. I never much cared for Bannon. He was an uglier, seamier version of Andrew Breitbart, and nothing about his new nationalist philosophy seemed to line up with any conservative principle. In 2015, Bannon weaponized Breitbart on your author because of my opposition to Trump. My prominence as an anti-Trump conservative led to a series of breathless Breitbart stories, including stories that targeted my children. Bannon emailed a friend that he planned to destroy my career and said, "This is going to be fun." Bannon's actions made my life hell on my family. His minions stalked and harassed my kids and clients. There was only one solution, and I knew I'd have to find the right moment. I was going to fuck Steve Bannon so hard his rheumy eyes popped out of his grizzled skull. You come at the king, you best not miss. In the fall of 2017, though Bannon was gone from the White House, he was still the hand of House Trump. He'd returned to Breitbart and was rising in media prominence, threatening primaries against every Republican senator except Ted Cruz, and a constant source of worry for Mitch McConnell and the National Republican Senatorial Committee. When Bannon bet the farm, every last acre of it, to play kingmaker and install pedo-curious Roy Moore in the United States Senate, I realized I was about to get a fuck-you moment with Bannon. While Bannon barnstormed with the wee molester Moore, giving rallies where he grunted out his nationalist populism message to friendly audiences, it looked like Moore had a better-than-average shot to win. It was, after all, Alabama, the Trump state, the reddest of the red, the craziest of the cray. When a super PAC contacted us, a key question came up. Can you help a Democrat win a Senate seat? Ethically, we mean? I'll be honest. I would have done the work just to prevent Moore from serving as a cancer in the GOP and a lunatic in the Senate. But the thought of beating Steve Bannon was deeply compelling. I wanted Bannon's face rubbed in his arrogance and his idiocy, not simply because he'd mess with me, or because I find his nationalist claptrap to be anathema to conservatism, but because I still treasure running real campaigns using art, heart, and data. We helped craft a series of ads for a super PAC that carefully targeted Republican women in six Alabama counties, pouring in tightly targeted, researched, and tested messages. The strongest was released the night Bannon held his infamous rally in Fairhope, Alabama. You're welcome, Steve. Our closing ad was simple. A series of pretty, upset girls on screen looking straight to camera while a voiceover asks, what if she was your little girl? Your daughter? Your sister? What if she was 16 years old? 15? Or even 14? Would you let a 32-year-old man date her? Undress her? Touch her? He called it dating. We call it unacceptable. That's why we can't support Roy Moore. Beating Roy Moore was a moral obligation. Beating Steve Bannon was a pleasure. Within days of the loss in Alabama, Bannon went from being the GOP's newest kingmaker to political leper. We all piled on, savagely. That's how politics still works, even for people who think they've reset all the rules and defied all the structures. Stephen Law, who runs Mitch McConnell's Senate Leadership Fund, brought out the lead pipe and went at Bannon's kneecaps. This is a brutal reminder that candidate quality matters regardless of where you're running, he said. Not only did Steve Bannon cost us a critical Senate seat in one of the most Republican states in the country, but he also dragged the President of the United States into his fiasco. McConnell advisor Josh Holmes chimed in as well, saying, I'd just like to thank Steve Bannon for showing us how to lose the reddest state in the Union. Matt Drudge, no fan of Bannon, hung the loss around Steve's neck with the headline, Bannon Busted. Your author didn't hold fire either. I tweeted at the time, Steve Bannon is a cancer. Good people of Alabama were the first dose of chemo. I was right. Gristle Icarus flew far too close to the sun. His election losses in Virginia and Alabama, his leaking Trump's dirty laundry and stories of White House discord to Fire and Fury author Michael Wolff, and his assertion that he might run for president led to a hard break with the White House and the Mercer family. He was fired from his perch at the helm of Breitbart with little ceremony and less mercy. The populist rebellion Bannon personified depended on his having a weaponized Breitbart battle station, a perception he spoke for the president, and buckets of sweet, sweet hedge fund cash from the Mercers. Without it, Bannon crashed so hard there was nothing but a greasy, smoking hole in the desert. From being the architect of a political movement that he promised would replace a moribund conservative establishment and dying Republican Party, Bannon has become a wandering, rootless political gypsy. He was last spotted cheering for neo-fascist parties in European elections. Carter Page. Watching former Trump campaign senior national security advisor Carter Page immolate himself and incriminate a half a dozen of his colleagues from the Trump-Putin 2016 campaign was a strange, almost guilty pleasure. Profoundly disconnected, socially awkward, and reeking of late-stage virginity, he gives off the creepy, uncanny valley vibe of a rogue, possibly murderous android, or of a man with a too extensive knowledge of human taxidermy in a soundproof van. Legal scholars watching Page's borderline insane interviews, reviewing his bizarre public statements and reading the wackadoodle transcripts of his testimony to congressional investigators express various levels of shock. His congressional hearing in October 2017 dismayed his friends in Trump world. It was a long, rambling performance art piece before the House that opened up entirely new venues for investigation by confirming large parts of the Steele dossier, which had been assembled to examine connections between the Trump campaign, his business enterprises, and his finances with Russia. The paper trail of his forays into Russia is an amazing mosaic of comic opera misunderstandings, grand and petty corruptions, grade school category errors, and fundamental delusions about Putin's kleptocracy. In short, Page is a perfect example of the ad hoc weirdness of the Trump campaign, Trumpism's deep, misplaced love of Putin's Russia, and the power of magical thinking among the coterie of misfit toys Trump calls his advisors. Page is weird and wrong, and in most campaigns, he'd be the weirdest, wrongest dog in the pack. In Trump world, he's in the middle quintile. A bizarre fascination with Russia as an ally shaped the view of Trump's foreign policy advisors Stephen Bannon, Mike Flynn, Stephen Miller, Sebastian Gorka, and the rest of the Foreign Policy Center for Kids Who Can't Read Good and Want to Read Good. Yes, a meaningful fraction of it is informed by an alt-rightish belief that the U.S. and Russia are white Christian allies in the global war on Islam and brown people in general. But some of it is just their natural inclination toward nationalist authoritarianism. Page didn't just talk the pro-Russia talk. He threw himself into the eager arms of SVR operatives. Like the rest of Trump world, Page brought a kind of underpants gnome theory of his bromance with Team Putin. Through some unknown alchemy, he expected to benefit Trump and gain influence and profit by his Russia foray. It's not that Page is stupid in the same way many Trump voters are, mulishly immune to processing empirical facts in the world around them. It's that Page's odd affect and thinking reflects something profoundly off-kilter about him, in the same way Trump's entire persona consists of bluster, magical thinking, and willful self-deception. The delta between Trump's imagination of himself and the brand image he desperately wants to sell is always wide. He's the billionaire lout playing the Manhattan sophisticate who gorges on fast food. He's a man with a lemur wig and a 5-pound bolus of chin waddle who thinks he's irresistible to women. He's the serially bankrupt master of the art of the deal, the TV talk show character who slithered into the Oval Office on a tide of Russian influence and now thinks he won on his merits. Page was an easy mark for Russian intelligence services because he lives in the same world of willful self-deception as Trump. Carter Page, international businessman of mystery, jet-setting wheeler-dealer, and foreign policy savant, was an image shared only by Carter Page, world-class dork and sucker. In the FBI investigation of a Russian intelligence cell that sought to suborn Page in 2013, the contempt in which the SVR agents held Page was clear. One wrote, "This is intelligence method to cheat. How else to work with foreigners? You promise a favor for a favor. You get the documents from him and tell him to go fuck himself." Foreign Policy reported, "Based on the FBI complaint, it appears Page never realized his Russian contact worked on behalf of Moscow's intelligence services." It's not simply that Page was credulous. His credulity was a hot wire inside the already Putin-philic Trump inner circle. Page is just the most obviously gullible of the Trump cadre. Mike Flynn, both venal and bitter, was also easy pickings. Sebastian Gorka would probably shine Putin's shoes in exchange for a gimcrack medal. Steve Bannon, a man better suited to promoting bum fights than grand strategy, thinks of himself as a player on par with Putin, which is an eye-rolling, hilarious thought to sane people. The rest of the jetsam drag behind Trump's sewage barge of a campaign is little different, and all of them are under the hot lights of Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia's intelligence program to manipulate the 2016 election and the role Trump and his campaign team may have played in it. Something about the prospect of spending a long time in a federal prison wearing an orange jumpsuit peels away the layers of bluster and pretense. Page's interview with the House was a situation in which he was in little legal jeopardy, but the flop sweat rolling off of him came through in almost every strange exchange. Following a Breitbartian anti-Hillary screed at the beginning of his testimony, Page had all the confidence of a whipped dog, lost and desperate. Like all Trump acolytes and supporters, Page learned a key lesson. Once the delusional sales pitch of Trumpism is pulled back, you're on your own. This strange, lost man is one of the most public examples of how ugly the world looks when the con and the crimes are exposed. But he sure as hell won't be the last. Paul Manafort. Manafort was a Trumpian character in Washington even before Trump. Crooked and corrupting, utterly immoral, he's the tainted wellspring of a dozen Washington and international scandals. Of course he was a perfect fit for Trump. Rumors of bad blood between Manafort and his Russian sugar daddy, Oleg Deripaska, were in the wind by the time he became chairman of Trump's campaign, and his ties to the Kremlin's favored strongmen and the nations surrounding Russia were clear. It tells you a lot that those were his good points in Trump's mind. How cutting must it have been for a man who spent years making millions as a skeezy fixer to have power and influence in Washington in his grasp, only to see it slip away. He was so close to being the respectable eminence grise instead of being the scumbag lobbyist of last resort for assorted kleptocrats, third world shitbirds, and international criminals. A man who once took briefcases full of cash from Russian billionaires now languishes in jail for attempting to obstruct justice in the Mueller investigation. Paul Manafort went from being the campaign chairman of a successful presidential run